At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When President Obama landed in the Saudi capital Riyadh yesterday, he was met on the tarmac by the local governor. Nobody important, really. In the language of diplomatic protocol, that is harsh. The 70-year-old U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia, built on oil and security, is tottering. Upended oil markets, regime disruptions across the Middle East, ISIS, Iran, 9/11 questions, they've all played a part. President Obama has said there'll be some changes. The Saudi royal court is seething. This hour on point, the U.S.-Saudi special relationship meets a tough present and a very uncertain future. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How do you see the U.S.-Saudi relationship? Yesterday, President Obama met with Saudi Arabia's King Salman at a one-on-one meeting in Riyadh.
The American people send their greetings, and we're very grateful for your hospitality, not just for this meeting, but also for hosting the GCC U.S. Summit.
The readout from Ben Rhodes, Deputy National Security Advisor to the President in Riyadh, put a good face on what surely was an uncomfortable meeting.
I think they both agreed that it was good to essentially have this opportunity to clear the air and to reaffirm that, even as there have been some tensions over the years, that on a set of core issues, we are in alignment.
Joining me first today from the Saudi capital of Riyadh is Angus McDowell, senior correspondent in Saudi Arabia for the Reuters news agency. Angus McDowell, thank you very much for taking time out from your reporting today. What do we know about the agenda of these talks and where they went?
What we do know is that major regional security issues such as Iran, Islamic State, the wars in Yemen, Syria, and Iraq were very close to the top of the agenda. But what we do also know is that there have been a lot of strains on the relationship over recent years, and which I think it's fair to say have been magnified by recent stumbles, such as the comments that President Obama made in a magazine last month, and by other issues, as you've already pointed out, such as the 9/11 bill in Congress.
So in terms of what was discussed yesterday, have the Saudis said, we got reassurances, we feel better? Have the Americans visiting said, we laid down the law? What do we know about what went on in this exchange?
President Obama just said a few minutes ago that that he has reaffirmed that the United States will deter and confront aggression against Gulf monarchies, giving the kind of reassurances, I suppose, that American officials have been promising would come. On the other hand, he has also said that the Gulf countries agreed to help de-escalate tensions in the region, which is something that he was hoping to get out of this summit with Gulf leaders. Of course, whether those words do reflect a warming in the relationship or whether they are go beyond what either side has anticipated they would get out of the meeting, I think it's probably too early to say.
Angus, what is the most disturbing? There are so many issues on the table these days, and for several years now between the U.S. and the Saudis. What is most disturbing to the Saudis?
What the Saudis really fear is that the Obama administration lacks the commitment both to engage with its allies in the Middle East and to confront what they regard as the life and death threat of expanding Iranian influence around the region. What they think is that Obama has been so fixated on pursuing the nuclear deal that was reached with Iran last year that he may have been prepared to overlook expanding Iranian involvement in Arab countries. And I think that what they've really wanted is tangible reassurances that that's not the case. And particularly what they would really like would be increased U.S. involvement in places like Syria, where they are backing rebels against President Bashar al-Assad, who is an ally of Iran.
And finally, Angus, just on the eve of the president's visit, a lot of heat in the United States about these 28 pages never released in the 9/11 report about the Saudi connection to the 9/11 attacks. Congress looking at legislation that might hold the Saudi government responsible in American courts if there's a connection there. And the Saudis threatening in return that they would sell off potentially hundreds of billions, maybe $1 trillion worth of American assets, treasuries, if Congress should do that. Where does the Saudi stance stand on all that very hot issue?
The Saudis have said for some years that they support the release of those pages. However, I think that that's a separate issue to the one of the bill now in Congress, where, as you rightly say, the foreign minister, the Saudi foreign minister, has been quoted as threatening to pull out Saudi assets from the U.S. And I think that what's certainly true is that the Saudis believe that they are the victims of a campaign of vilification in Western media by human rights groups, by some lobbying groups, which they think is has greatly ratcheted up over recent years. Of course, that may stem partly from the simple fact that they view issues like human rights, and the role of religion in society so very differently from Western societies that they sometimes struggle to see quite why Western criticism of those issues is so acute.
The president into Saudi Arabia, having sat down with the Gulf Cooperation Council and now on his way to the UK. Angus McDowell is Reuters senior correspondent with us from Riyadh. Angus, thank you very much for spending a minute with us today.
You're welcome.
With me now from Princeton, New Jersey, is Bernard Haeckel, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton, co-editor of Saudi Arabia in Transition. He keeps a close watch on the Saudi royal family, Saudi society. He was in Saudi Arabia just in December. Next week, we'll be there again, meeting with Deputy Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman and other key officials. Bernard Haeckel, welcome back to On Point. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks.
We're going to look at the U.S. side of this equation, but take us deeper to how the Saudis see the years of the Obama administrations now and their impact on this relationship. What's going on inside Saudi Arabia that's led to so much, so many sounds of discontent from their side?
Well, what's happened in Saudi Arabia is that you have a new king who acceded to the throne in 2015, in January. And he and his son, who's the deputy crown prince, mm-hmm. are quite aggressive and see Iran. I mean, see two major challenges to the country. The first is regional, coming from Iran, and they feel that the United States doesn't understand the nature of that challenge. They feel that Obama is either naive or deluded about the danger of Iran. And the other challenge that they're most concerned with is the domestic economy and being able to diversify away from oil to other, to an economy that is more robust and less dependent on oil and that produces jobs for the huge youth bulge that they have, where something like 70% of the population is under the age of 30, and they have to produce several million jobs in the next decade.
Oil prices have come so far down. I'm looking at a recent headline here. Saudi Arabia takes out a $10 billion, $10 billion in bank loans, the most they've done in, the first real debt in a quarter century. How badly are the rock-bottom oil prices hurting the Saudi kingdom?
you know, they are hurting to some extent, and there are certainly austerity measures that are happening, including for the first time discussion of taxation and diminishing the subsidies on energy, water, and electricity and gasoline prices. But you know, the Saudis still have $600 billion or so in reserves, mostly I think in the United States in treasuries. And they have very little debt. They have the debt that you just mentioned, and they can still borrow considerably both on the domestic market and on the international market. So they're not like Nigeria or Russia or even Iran in terms of really feeling the pain. They will, I suspect, feel the pain if prices don't change for 3 to 5 years. Then they really have to face a much more difficult situation.
There's been a kind of long-term understanding between the United States and Saudi Arabia. How would the Saudis see the fundamental dynamic of that? What's the fundamental deal that these two countries have had?
So the deal, which was established in 1945, was a simple and straightforward one. The United States would provide for the security and protection of the Saudi government and regime and therefore the royal family. And in return, this government would produce oil and behave and steward that oil reserve very responsibly. In other words, they would be responsible actors in the global economy, which they have been with one exception, perhaps now a second. I'll get to that in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And that they would basically support American, American dominance in the region, and they have done that as well. The other aspect of the deal was that they wouldn't interfere in each other's internal affairs, and so you know they don't want the United States talking about human rights or about women or whether women can drive or not and that sort of thing.
Is the deal still on, Bernard? We just got a couple of seconds before the break here. We'll come back, but is the deal still on? Is it in trouble?
I think it's still on because actually the deal is based on structural and fundamental sort of physical realities. It's not about the whims of a president or of a king. And so I can't see the United States president moving away from it.
And yet, has Obama dealt with them as presidents before, maybe as every president before?
Certainly not. He has been very different.
We'll come back and look at that and much more. Bernard Haykel, please stand by at Princeton. We're talking about the president's visit to Saudi Arabia. How do you see the U.S.-Saudi relationship? Do these two countries still need each other, still trust each other? A little? Enough? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the president's visit to Saudi Arabia and deep tensions around an old special relationship. Here's the sound of Saudi TV news channel Al Arabiya reporting President Obama's arrival this week in Riyadh. The president coming for the fourth time. No other president has come four times while sitting for a summit, mini summit with the Saudi king. At the start, of course, of that summit of leaders of the Gulf Cooperation Council. But there are plenty of issues here, not least the way Saudi Arabia has handled troubles across its southern border in Yemen in January. Saudi-led coalition struck rescue teams in Yemen, killing at least 18, wounding dozens. There have been so many complaints. Here's just one clip of the explosions from Russia today. Real trust issues lately between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Bernard Haykel joins us, professor of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. Bernard Haykel, you were beginning to describe how this president's relationship with the Saudi monarchy, Saudi Arabia, has been different from really all others.
Yes, it has been in that he has not played by, you know, what is called the playbook. For instance, the Saudis have always insisted that the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador in Riyadh, be a personal friend of the president so that they have a direct line of access to him.
Mm-hmm.
He has never, appointed such a person. He also has not sort of given them the kind of deference that earlier presidents, certainly the Bush presidents, gave them. And by opening up a line of communication with the Iranians and signing the nuclear deal, in addition to a number of other things he's done, for instance, they see him as having not backed President Mubarak during the 2011 demonstrations in Cairo. They see that he broke his word on Syria when chemical weapons were used. You know, a whole series of issues and policies that he's adopted, culminating with this interview with Jeffrey Goldberg in The Atlantic that basically confirmed all their suspicions about the man, that he basically has contempt for them. And so they don't like him, and they're very happy to see the back of him.
Before he was ever elected, he called Saudi Arabians the Saudis are so-called allies. That Atlantic piece quotes Australian Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull as having asked President Obama, "Are the Saudis your friends?" And in this account, anyway, Obama replied, "It's complicated." In that same piece, he called them free riders. In fairness, he called European allies free riders as well. You say the contempt is mutual. What's the contempt from the Saudi side?
The contempt is that he is – I mean, they think they see him as naive, and that's, you know, putting it politely. They also see him as arrogant and as someone who can redraft the rules of the game in the Middle East and how America engages with the Middle East. And, you know, by the way, that sentiment that the Saudis have is also shared by Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel. So they're not alone in regarding President Obama as having made very major errors of judgment in pursuing Middle Eastern policy.
So what's their response? I mean, are the Saudis cool-headed about this? Are they freaking out at this coolness?
No, well, yeah, that's where it gets scary, actually, and that's where it gets troublesome for the United States and for the world, is that their response has been overly aggressive. They've engaged in a war in Yemen that has actually not resulted in anything good for them, or certainly not for the Yemenis. It's a humanitarian catastrophe. They've broken diplomatic relations with the Iranians. They're withdrawing all their money from Lebanon, which might destabilize that country. They're very, very aggressive, and they're overreaching. And, you know, their reach is farther than their grasp, frankly, in terms of how they can project force in the region. And they're not up to the task of really combating Iran. Iran has very serious and much more formidable capabilities than the Saudis do. And the Saudis will have to build up their capacity, and that will take a decade, if not more, because they've always relied on the United States to protect them. And domestically, they're also engaged in a very aggressive economic reform strategy, which, you know, I'm not convinced will be successful.
A decade or more to build up to confront or stand up to Iran, but they're already spending at a tremendous level. I think they've displaced Moscow as one of the top defense spenders in the world.
Yes, they have. In fact, they are, I think, probably the third largest spenders on weaponry. You know, it's not kit that makes a great army. Mm-hmm. It's the human beings. Mm-hmm. And it's building that human capacity that they need to work on. And that you can't buy.
Bernard Haeckel, please stand by at Princeton. John Alterman joins us right now as well from Washington, Senior Vice President, Director of the Middle East Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's got his Zbigniew Brzezinski Chair in Global Security Geostrategy there. Former State Department official. John Alterman, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Tom. Hi, Bernie.
Hey.
What do you see going on in this meeting, and what has brought the relationship to this pass? How serious is it?
It's pretty serious, but it also has an end date on it in that everybody knows when the president is leaving office. I think there's probably a wheels up party going on the White House plane, and there's a wheels up party on the Saudi side that this is the last time these two sides have to talk to each other. As Bernie's described quite well, there's a lot of mutual contempt. There's a sense on each side that the other side just doesn't get it, that the president believes that the Saudis don't understand the need to accommodate Iran in the region. They want the U.S. to fight all their wars for them. And the Saudis feel that this president simply doesn't understand the nature of threat. He doesn't understand the nature of evil. He doesn't understand the value of longstanding allies. And each side, quite frankly, is really convinced that it's right. And the other side is wrong, and each side wants to lecture to the other side and is frustrated that the other side doesn't want to listen to lectures and see the light.
What's your sense of the new relationship that President Obama has been searching for, if that's the right way of putting it? How would he like to see? Is it a fundamental change? What would it look like?
Well, the president has spoken quite explicitly about the need for a new equilibrium in the Gulf. And what a new equilibrium looks like, I think, in his mind, is that the United States plays a less active role and the Saudis and the Iranians reach some sort of accommodation, which means more Iranian influence and less Saudi influence, less Gulf Arab influence, because the U.S. won't be propping that up. What many of the Gulf Arabs say, certainly all the leadership I've spoken to, is that represents not a new equilibrium, but a continued slide toward greater Iranian domination, which will be a threat not only to the Gulf Arab states, but also to the U.S. and its allies. I was just meeting with a senior Iranian official yesterday in New York, and there is also an Iranian sense of hostility toward the Gulf Arabs, a sense of why does the United States continue to hang out with these guys? They're the ones who are killing Americans through terrorism, not the Iranians. There needs to be this rebalancing. I think the White House is open to the Iranian explanation, and the fact that the White House appears open to the Iranian explanation keeps the Gulf Arabs up at night.
Bernard Haykel, how do you interpret the president's desire to move toward Iran or give Iran more, is it right to say, more breathing room in the region? He's got some strategic read on this whole part of the world that in his mind requires that. What is it?
Look, I think that dealing with Iran in some ways is a lot easier than dealing with the Arabs. First of all, the leadership structure is much more centralized, and you're dealing with a state that has institutions. So it's more familiar than, let's say, you know, a bunch of
princes
and tribes and all that. And I think he really, from Kenya, thinks that, you know, tribes are kind of a bad thing. So that's one way to gloss things. I think also he is, you know, concerned about his legacy. He wants to leave some major signature foreign policy accomplishment. And I think he's made an analogy that, you know, perhaps Cuba and Iran are similar. And if he can open doors to Cuba, why can't he do the same to Iran? I think he's frankly fooling himself. I think the Iranians, operate at a very different level, and their capacities, especially through the use of non-state actors, is very troubling. And it's ultimately a revolutionary regime that has yet to decide whether it's a revolution or just a normal state that will act responsibly. My bet is that it will not shed its revolutionary credentials. It will always use non-state actors, and that's very troubling, regardless of how well the nuclear deal pans out.
Non-state actors, do you mean terrorists? Do you mean
– Yes. I mean terrorist groups. I mean, yes, not regular armies, not state armies, but, you know, groups like Hezbollah and the Shiite militias of southern Iraq and the various militias that they have in Syria now. That include even Afghan and Pakistani Shiites. I mean, you're dealing with a country that has tremendous reach through the use of terror.
John Alterman, that's kind of an ironic punch at Iran right now, when in Washington everybody's talking about these 28 pages in the 9/11 report that pertain to Saudis and perhaps members of the Saudi monarchy or government and perhaps some role in 9/11. I mean, that's hot as can be in the U.S. right now. Talk about non-state actors. They brought down the World Trade Center, those attackers.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of that is politics.
And what do you mean by that? You don't think there's anything incriminating in those 28 pages?
I think what there probably is, I haven't seen the 28 pages. My guess, having read, you know, a fair bit of intelligence through my career, is that what it says is we can't rule out certain things, that there were individuals who we don't have evidence were acting in on state orders. You know, intelligence is never as good as you want it to be. And my guess is that it's sort of a fudge, and it doesn't give anybody a completely clean bill of health, but it also doesn't provide an indictment. And there are people for political reasons who want to criticize this side or that side. They want to criticize the White House. They want to criticize the Saudis who want to make this a larger issue than it is. I think Bernie's right that there's something difficult about the fact that the Iranians don't fight the way we like to fight, because we like to fight in ways that give us instant advantages. We like to fight
with our big armies and military.
With huge armies, and we like to use our airplanes to take out tanks on the battlefield, and we use our night vision and everything else. The Iranians like to do things where you do swarming activities with small boats. you do things that look ambiguous, you support a group that doesn't appear to be a combatant force until they become a combatant force, all these other kinds of things which don't really give you a casus belli, don't really give you an excuse for war, but certainly advance Iranian interests. And the U.S. isn't really set up to deal with that very well. And from the perspective of our Gulf Arab allies, you know, we are helping them build up these tremendous armies to fight the kinds of wars they're unlikely to need to fight. And when you put them into a war situation, as they've had in Yemen, they don't perform very well.
Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, the non-state actors roll on. We're looking at the significant challenges right now to the U.S.-Saudi relationship as President Obama has wrapped up a visit to Riyadh. Go to Mohammed, calling from Seattle, Washington. Mohammed, you're on the air. Thank you for calling. What do you think?
Hi, Tom. Hi, guest. I just wanted to kind of chime in on this. I lived in Saudi Arabia at some point in my life, and then on, as well as throughout the Middle East. And mm-hmm. I just want to kind of give you a perspective of what this relationship is viewed on the ground, which is viewed very negatively by majority of the Muslim world. You know, a lot of Muslims, whether you're Shiite, whether you're Sunni, they reject this Wahhabi ideology that Saudi Arabia has used its petrodollars to spread out throughout the Muslim world. We don't have a way of fighting against that because we're fighting against billions of dollars. And so when these radical groups rise, they're all kind of based and founded on this Wahhabi ideology. You know, and when the United States supports Saudi Arabia the way it does, they see them in cahoots with the Saudis. I mean, just take Yemen, mm-hmm. for example. The Houthi yep. rebels were fighting ISIS and were fighting al-Qaeda, yet here we are supporting the Saudis against the Houthis. So now the Houthis view the U.S. You know, as an enemy. The guys over at Intercept do a great job of reporting on this, and they said that in a recent poll, 82% of Yemenis view the United States as an enemy.
So, Mohammed, you're saying forget the special relationship? We don't need it? I mean, there was a time when it seemed necessary just for energy flow, oil, and all the rest.
Yeah, of course. I mean, forget it. I mean, because what real positive benefit? Fine, you know, we had oil and all this money that came in from the Saudis, but what other benefit is there? I mean, what perspective, whether it's human rights, whether it's, you know, progress in the Middle East, you know, where do the Saudis align with us? Our interests don't align other than securing the stability of the Saudi family. I mean, people talk about we need the Saudis for stability in the Middle East. How's that working out for us so far?
Yeah.
I mean, who's the real power? Who is the superpower here? Is the United States or is it Saudi Arabia?
Mohammed, I appreciate your call. Let me take it to my guest, and I'm very glad for your call from Seattle. Bernard Hickel, can you respond to that? I mean, the president was asked, again, reportedly, are the Saudis your friend? He replied, it's complicated. That means not necessarily. Mohammed says no.
Right. So, you know, there is a very common belief that basically all of Islamic radicalism and violent, you know, jihadi activity is because of Saudi Arabia's promotion of its version of Islam. I think that's an overly simplistic argument. You know, there's been an Islamic revival throughout the Arab world and beyond.
But haven't the Saudis colored it, as Mohammed says, with billions spent on promoting this version as it's had a revival?
They have promoted a literalist version, but not necessarily a violent version. The version that they promote is intolerant of other Muslims who are unlike them. It's not necessarily directed at the West. So it's a very complicated mm-hmm. argument.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Houthis, for instance, I mean, just to kind of burst the bubble just for a second,
okay.
Look, if you look at the Houthis, who are a Shiite militia, their slogan is death to America and death to all Jews. So it's not, you know, and they're Shiites. So, you know, they have nothing to do with Saudi Arabia.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea that somehow the Saudis are responsible for all of Islamic violence and terrorism is simply overly simplistic, as I said, and it's not true. The basic deal, though, is that the Saudis have been, until now, responsible actors in the way they steward their hydrocarbon reserves, and that is crucial for the global economy. And they've always backed American dominance of the region, which, again, from a realpolitik perspective, is all we should really care about.
John Altman, do we still need Saudi Arabia in strict energy terms?
We don't need Saudi Arabia in strict energy terms now. In fact, the United States is now the world's largest oil producer, not Saudi Arabia. That's not to say in the longer term we might not. I couldn't predict 10 years ago that we'd have the unconventional oil and gas revolution we've had in the United States. People currently think that it's not going to last more than about 20 years. Whether we still need it or not, I don't know. I think the Saudis are increasingly concluding that they're going to have oil long after the world needs oil. And as Bernie was suggesting earlier, you know, with their economic plans, they're trying to look into a post-oil economy. And they have a tremendously difficult time doing that because most of the economy is about working for the government. It's not about creating value.
We've got a real recipe for all kinds of ferment here. President Obama in the middle of it this week in Saudi Arabia. John Alterman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Bernard Haykel at Princeton. Please stand by. Listeners, you can join us. Has President Obama been right to challenge the Saudis on so many fronts? I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. And we're talking about President Obama's visit to Saudi Arabia and deep tensions around the old special U.S.-Saudi relationship. Bernard Haykel is with us from Princeton University, John Alterman from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. You can join us as well. Has President Obama been right to challenge the Saudis on so many fronts? And with all energy production up and oil at rock-bottom prices, does Saudi Arabia still matter like it did? Do you want to know what's in those classified or confidential 28 pages of the 9/11 report about Saudi Arabia? And from fighting ISIS to Yemen to Mideast peace and terror in Iran, are the Saudis a partner or a problem in your eyes? The president in Saudi Arabia this week, speaking this morning at the GCC summit, saying we've got to make room again for or deal with, work with, Iran. Saudis, it makes them crazy. Fingernails on a blackboard. Here's the president in Riyadh.
None of our nations have an interest in conflict with Iran. We welcome an Iran that plays a responsible role in the region, one that takes concrete, practical steps to build trust and resolve its differences with its neighbors by peaceful means and abides by international rules and norms.
Bernard Haykel, John Alterman, let me put to you a comment from one of our listeners on Facebook. This is Aaron. It says, I neither can nor want to defend the Saudi regime, but let's at least have a realistic idea of the consequences of our actions in dealing with them. And he writes, this is not a part of the world willing to accept American values, ideas. We've seen that quite clearly the last 15 years or so. The regime is so fundamentally extreme, it's unlikely to moderate over time. But he says, so what's worse, the status quo or another quagmire like Iraq or Syria? Not a rhetorical question he's writing to us here. People need to ask themselves, because sure as hell the U.S. neither can nor wants to spend the money or blood to enact another Marshall Plan there. There's a kind of assumption that if we stick with Saudi Arabia, we stick with some kind of stability. Do you buy that, John?
I don't know what stick with Saudi Arabia really means in this context. I mean, Saudi Arabia is a very conservative place. It is conservative in its interpretation of Islam. It is conservative in its interpretation of authority. It is a very top-down kind of society. And the United States feels much more comfortable with bottom-up kinds of societies. I think the president, one of his objectives in talking to the Saudis is to say, you have to be more accepting of bottom-up societies. And the Saudis say, that's not the kind of people we have. That's not the society we have. You've got your conditions and we have ours. And while we are adapting, we're adapting as fast as we can. The Americans say you have to adapt faster. I don't think that these problems are going to be resolved. I think the United States and Saudi Arabia are going to remain dramatically different societies. The question is, how much difference can you accommodate? And where do you want the differences to spill out, and where do you need to keep them contained? I think that's where the president's attitude has been, we'll allow more distance, especially at the top. The Saudi ambassador in Washington traditionally has had an open door to the president of the United States. Mm-hmm. That's not happening now. And the question in the Saudis' mind right now is, will it ever happen again? And it worries them that the answer might be no.
Of course, we've got a presidential election coming up. Do the Saudis, Bernard, think that it's going to snap back to old form if it's any of the major contenders now, if it's Hillary Clinton or, I don't know, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, or Bernie Sanders, you name it, or be something different?
Well, I suspect that, you know, they probably feel most comfortable with Hillary Clinton because she's a known quantity. They've dealt with her husband, and she's she strikes them as a practical politician or pragmatic politician. I think they're just as befuddled as most of the rest of the world as to what a Trump presidency will mean. And they probably don't feel comfortable with the unknown. Just like John said, I mean, they are very, very conservative, and they like a highly personalized relationship with people that they're familiar with and that they know and they would consider friends.
How stable is this monarchy, this regime? What does it stand on, Bernard?
Well, it stands on several things. As John also said, it's a conservative top-down society that has a system of entitlements with its own people. It provides very considerable support for the Saudi population. Two-thirds of the Saudis work for the public sector. They provide, you know, free health, free education, and lots and many other things. As long as they can do that, which is linked to the price of oil in the long term, you know, they can stay strong. The other thing that they base their power on is the royal family and how solid and the royal family remains bound together. You know, this is a royal family that dates its history back to the middle of the 18th century. So it's not a creation of Western power or Western colonialism. So they have deep roots of legitimacy in their history and in their society, and they use Islam very effectively to dominate their society. And they also have an extremely powerful state that is coercive when it needs to be and co-optational when it has to be as well. And they've been very effective at fragmenting their population and not allowing for any mobilization of the population against them. And we haven't seen any demonstrations or virtually no demonstrations except for some amongst the Shiites in the eastern province since 2011.
Let's hear from our listeners more, if we may. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Bob, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This is a complicated issue. It's well worth getting out there and getting it unraveled. It goes way back. Now, this is just my point of view. I've studied history all of my adult life, and this goes way back to when the Saudis have something that the United States needs, that's oil. The Saudis aren't themselves a colonial power, but the United States is, and they use the Saudis to maintain their colonial power around the world. And I would say that Standard Oil pretty much pulled a blackmail job on the United States government way back and got it, you know, wrapped around.
Bring it up to date, Bob. What should we do now, my friend?
Well, we got to change the oil predicament. The whole energy structure needs to be changed.
Well, that's happened to a large extent, hasn't it?
Cannabis was a huge thing that came down right along with the Standard Oil blackmailing of the United States government and the destruction of family farms. So that's something to consider all around the world right now with the environment and the climate the way it is. We need to be supporting small farmers all over the world and reforestation all over the world and hemp for industry all over the world.
Bob, we got it. I guess it comes back to that. Is there a possible change on this energy front? The world energy markets have certainly changed. American production has changed, but Saudi Arabia's still got a lot of oil. If it got bad enough, I mean, could we wake up one day and the Saudis would say, you know what, that was nice, but you're not our buddy and protector anymore. China is our buddy and protector now. Or Russia is our buddy and protector now. Is that within the realm of imagination, John?
Not really. The Chinese are desperate to avoid getting dragged into what they see as a series of interminable problems in the Middle East. They're quite content to have the United States involved, partly because they love to watch the United States get a bloody nose in the Middle East. Partly they think if the United States is getting a bloody nose in the Middle East, they can't give China a bloody nose in East Asia.
And they may
so
be right.
So as far as they're concerned, this is working pretty well. What they're concerned about with Middle Eastern oil is that the United States can cut off their access to it because we have such naval dominance, not only through the Straits of Malacca, but also through the Indian Ocean. So they are part of this Belt and Road initiative the Chinese are putting forward is to have access to energy that the United States would have a harder time to interrupt in a time of crisis. But I don't think the Chinese are looking to get more actively engaged in the Middle East if they can help it. The Russians are delighted to have us have problems in the Middle East, but I don't think they want to control the place. The question that Americans have to answer is, do we want to continue to expend energy in the Middle East as part of our role playing as a global power. And if we don't play that global role because we say we're self-sufficient, how does that affect other interests if our allies start thinking we don't really need to rely on the United States or we can't afford to rely on the United States the way we have in the past? What kinds of subtler effects does that have on American security, on American security at home?
Bernard, do you think we're moving to that track? President Obama's had a difficult relationship with the Saudis, but is he over? And they're now maybe waiting for him to play out the clock and for him to be gone from the White House. But has he moved us into a new relationship that may stick and take us further down that road that John describes? What are the consequences if we get cooler and more distant from the Saudis?
I don't think that my speculation is that the Obama view of the Saudis and of the region is an exception rather than the rule, and that the next president of the United States will revert back to the old policy of being quite close to them, precisely because John put his finger on it, which is that if we continue to play the role of the global superpower that is protecting shipping lanes and oil flow from the Middle East to China and other places, then we have to have this force projection into the region, and we will continue to, you know, to defend the Saudis and to defend these maritime lanes, and that costs a lot of money. But that's a choice we have taken after the British Empire left that region. And the real question is whether we want to keep playing that role or not. And I think that we have to, because the alternative would be such disruption of the global economy that it would end up costing us much more.
It leaves you wondering if this is all a tempest in a teapot, if the basic structure takes us right back to that. John Altman, how about it? If that's the interpretation, then is all this strain and talk about U.S.-Saudi conflict just kind of, I don't know, window dressing, but the heart of it stays unchanged. The U.S. is going to stay in this relationship, no big change or not?
Well, first, I think there is likely to be a change with the next president. I'm not completely confident, but my sense is that if the Saudis no longer play that role as the global banker of oil, the people who, if there's suddenly a shortage of oil in the market, the Saudis rush in. Well, the fact is there's a glut of oil in the market. Mm-hmm. Everybody's running out of storage space. So if the Saudis lose that role, I think this sense that you need the Saudis have to have access to the Oval Office, I think that is likely to go down. I also, as I talk to Americans around the country, I do get a sense of war fatigue, a sense that we have too many priorities at home. We can't afford to be spending all our money overseas. Our issues are, you know, the Middle East is full of terrorism, and the more we get involved, the more we're going to be fighting these wars that never end.
And what does that mean? Leave it alone? Let Saudi Arabia dangle? Get out?
Well, I think there's a sentiment for that in the country. I think there's a sentiment, as Bernie suggested, that we have to play this role because there are costs, profound costs, if we don't. I'm quite frankly frustrated that we're much of the way through a presidential campaign. Nobody's begun to talk about the issues of what the United States needs to do in the world. And I think we need to have a very serious discussion about state actors and non-state actors. Are we principally concerned? Are our real threats going to come from other countries? Are they going to come from countries that support terrorist groups? Or are they going to come from terrorist groups themselves terrorizing people in Main Street across the United States? It requires very different kinds of forces on our side, very different policies, and we haven't begun to have a serious discussion about what we want our security policy to be going forward, what role diplomacy and relationships with countries such as Saudi Arabia play in that.
Bernard, how do you see the Saudis fundamentally looking at ISIS? Do they want it gone, or do they see it as a, you know, Sunni bulwark against Iran?
So here, the answer is complicated. I think that the Saudi royal family regards ISIS as an enemy, and certainly ISIS would like to take out the Saudi royal family and take over Saudi Arabia. That is the prize for ISIS. However, the Saudis, the Saudi government, Saudi royals think that, you know, there are other priorities that are more important in terms of a threat to the regime. So Iran is much more of a threat than ISIS is. That's a priority. The war in Syria, Assad and his backers, Hezbollah, are also a much greater threat to them. So, you know, they think that ISIS is a bad thing, but it's not on the top of the list. Now, as far as the Saudi population is concerned, the public, and we don't have actual data on this, but it's just anecdotal, I think quite a few people look at ISIS and they say, you know, these guys are out there fighting Shiites and fighting Americans and fighting, you know, the enemies of Islam. And that's a good thing as long as they remain out there. But we don't want them coming here and ruling us. We have too much to lose. So there's a bit of vicarious support for ISIS, but, you know, at a distance, not wanting them to come close.
I think there's a sense that their heart is in the right place, even if sometimes they're a little misguided.
The heart of ISIS is in the right place.
The heart is in the right place. They have to be more properly guided. They have to choose their targets more correctly. Maybe they get a little carried away. But there are certainly senior Saudis who have expressed a lot of sympathy for, if not the actions of ISIS, the software. It's just the commands that are being put into the software are giving you the wrong stuff. But there's a lot of, as Bernie has spoken about in other places, there's a lot of theological continuity between the foundations of ISIS thinking, at least as they say, their foundations of their thinking, and Saudi official thinking.
Doesn't that take us right back to a kind of sense that Obama's really onto something here when he looks at Saudi Arabia and says, wait a minute? I mean, if they're sort of, I don't know, philosophically or more inclined to say, hey, ISIS is all right, how does that work for the United States?
But the missing piece from the Saudi perspective is that the ideology that the Saudis put forward is all about following the commands of legitimate leadership. And the commands of legitimate leadership says now is not the time to wage jihad against this enemy. You have to stand down. You can't be fighting. And that very top-down understanding of the theology is the orthodoxy that is certainly found in Islamic texts and is consistent with the ideology of the state. What ISIS has done is they said, we're taking the fighting stuff and we're taking away the control stuff, and therefore we're fighting anybody we decide to fight.
Our allies in this fight, the Saudis, looking at ISIS and thinking, well, maybe they're all right, just a little confused. Watch this space. This zone of tension between the U.S. and Saudi is by no means resolved, certainly not resolved in this quick trip by the president. John Altman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, Bernard Haykel at Princeton. John, thank you for helping us look under the covers here today. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Tom.
And Bernard Haykel at Princeton. Thank you so much, Bernard.
Thank you, Tom.
Wow. More to come here, no doubt. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR.